The White Network presents The Heretic's Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 150th edition of The Heretic's Hour with me, Carolyn Yeager, on this March 4th, 2013. Yes, before the show, I decided to count up the number of individual programs there had been. Not reruns, all original content programs, which wasn't too hard because I have the archive going all the way back to the first show on March 1st, 2010 at CarolynYeager.net. And I discovered, you know, I just had an impulse. I've been thinking about doing it, and I didn't do it. And tonight I had a little time, and so I said, I'm going to go and do that. And I, as I said, it didn't take too long. And I discovered that I had this. Tonight's show was the 150th Heretics Hour, and that I was reminded that my first show was on March 1st, 2010, so this would be the three-year anniversary of the Heretics Hour also. On Broadway, they would call this a long-running hit. 3 years is 52 weeks a year, makes 156 weeks altogether, but a few weeks off for Christmas. That I've had, three Christmases and one New Year, and then some enforced layoff because of my counter voice of reason. Otherwise, a perfect record, of new shows every week, and it kind of amazes even me. I really don't know, how it kept going so consistently, but it has. So a happy third birthday to the Heretics Hour tonight, and I'm glad I didn't miss it. My inner promptings are working well. I'm pleased that I have some of you listening with me tonight for this 150th show. And I might ask you, what would prompt someone to do a show right up against a show like The Heretics Hour that's been on for so long and has been a very popular show for so long? I ask that, you know, who would do that and why would they do it? Tonight's subject is about large-scale deceptions and what are sometimes called the big lie or a hoax or psychological operation, other words, PSYOP. Or today we sometimes call it manufactured reality. Tonight, returning from this past Saturday afternoon show is Harlan Schulke. He will be calling in about 2 minutes. He wanted to give me time to make my anniversary announcement, or I wanted him to give me time to do it so he wouldn't have to wait on the phone. And on Saturday, Harlan and I discussed Sandy Hook, and tonight we will move into some other areas, but maybe say a little bit more about Sandy Hook if there is time. To start off as an introduction to the nature of deception is that it is simply based on the proclivity of some people to lie. That's, you know, when I think about deception, it always just comes down to lies. That's what it is. There's nothing fancier than that about it. And this proclivity is across the board in Jews. We find it again and again and again. It's a Jewish MO or method of operation. And I think it's both learned and genetic. A case in point is a man who recently died, a Jewish man, and who got some write-up because of his death. The man's name is, Stephen Hessel, although he spells his name Stefan, with the accent on the E. I don't know if that's supposed to be French for Stephen or what, but because he's born German and then naturalized French. Anyway, his story, I've talked about him in the past, and I'll remind you of that, in connection with the Alliance Universelle, Israelite Universelle, when I was talking about the Protocols of Zion on one of those programs that I did. And I found him to be very interesting, and I did quite a bit of research on him. So here's what I know about him. I think it fits in to tonight's show. I'm just going to start out with this. And continue even after Harlan calls in, and we'll do this, and then he can get into his thing. This Stephen Hessel In 2010, the reason he's well known now is he wrote a 48-page pamphlet called, in English, Time for Outrage. It was, it sold 4.5 million copies in 35 countries. It was only 48 pages, but it hit something in people, and it is supposed to be the inspiration behind the Occupy movement. Being as he was already in his 90s, that was kind of an amazing thing that he did something that got so much attention. And he died at the age of 95 just a few days ago. Now, but this Hessel is not a great guy in my estimation. He was born into a Jewish family in Berlin in 1917. And his father was Jewish and a journalist. And supposedly his mother was Protestant. The family moved to France when he was only 8 years old. That would have been 1925. But he didn't take French nationality until the late 1930s. So that would have been after Hitler was established and doing well and had started really more seriously deporting Jews or talking about deporting Jews. And so that, I guess, caused him to decide to give up his German citizenship altogether and become a French citizen. And in 1940, when France capitulated to the German forces and signed the armistice, the 23-year-old Hessel, who was, now here's Harlan calling in, and let me take this call, folks, and not make a mistake doing it. Okay, that should do it. Yep, here
Hello?
He is.
Oh,
yes,
hi.
Hello.
Carolyn.
Hi, Harlan. Yes.
How are you?
I'm fine. Nice. Nice that this call went smoothly. And I'm in the midst here. I know you couldn't be listening while you're getting ready to call in and so on. And I told everyone about you being on and that we were just talking about these subjects of deception on Saturday. And now we're going to do some more of it. And I'm starting out with a story about Stephen Hessel. I sent that.
Okay.
And I have a little bit more. It won't take too long. And
all right.
You can chime in here wherever you want to. And mm-hmm. then I want you to go on with your main topic for tonight. So I was saying that he is, maybe I'm really not properly introducing you to anybody who's listening who didn't listen on Saturday or doesn't know. Your name is Harlan Schulke. Harlan Schulke, and we'll give some more information about you after I finish this little story here. So this Hessel, in 1940, he was 23 years old, and he refused to follow Marshal Petain's collaborationist Vichy government, and he fled to London, where he joined General Charles de Gaulle's resistance fighters. From there, he returned. This is the way. Now, from here on, it's the story. I wouldn't vouch for any of it, but, you know, it could be. Probably some of it's true, but some of it, of course, is false. But he returned to France to organize resistance communication networks in advance of the 1944 Allied invasion of France. Now, if you're organizing resistance to the if you're organizing, causing trouble to the communication networks of the Germans in mm-hmm. advance of the Allied invasion, well, you're an enemy of the Germans. So he was arrested by the Gestapo in 1944 for doing that and deported to Buchenwald and also at Dora concentration camps. Now, you know, to me, the Gestapo were doing their job. They did their job very well, didn't they? They were good at what they did, and they weren't the kind of brutal murderers that they're made out to be. They were very, very effective. And, this guy should have been, to my mind, he should have been executed. But instead, he was sent to Buchenwald. And Buchenwald was the place where all these communist-type partisans were sent. And they were, I don't know why they put them all there, but, you know, they were in such a, there was such a strong group there that they kind of ran the place. So
right, that's what I've read, too.
Yeah. But anyway.
An organization.
Yeah, but anyway, this guy, his story, he says that at Buchenwald, he suffered waterboarding torture. Huh. You know, I think that's a big lie right there, because I've never heard of waterboarding, but he was one of the first to say that, and people now try to repeat that, but I never heard of any waterboarding, at that time. I think the Israelis invented that, and, Cheney learned about it, and, you know, we started all of that. But anyway, you know, the thing is that, he told all this in 2011 in an interview after his popular pamphlet came out, and he got to be well known. And then his big stories and lies came out. And so he's there asking him about himself, and he says,
became popular through the Occupy movement?
Yeah, through that pamphlet he wrote, which was Time for Outrage, and it sold 4.5 million copies. And it said supposedly he wasn't the Occupy, but supposedly it was the inspiration for the Occupy movement.
I see.
After this all came out, he got some interviews, and this is when he first said this. And here's what he said when asked in 2011 how he survived torture. He said, the third time of waterboarding, I said, now I'll tell you. And I told them a lie, of course. You know, now you can't get away with that. Does he think, you know, this is just bravado. You tell lies, they know if you're telling a lie or not. I mean, you know. Anyway, he adds, one survives torture. So many people, unfortunately, have been tortured, but it's not a thing to recommend. Right? He's just talking silly about it, you know. Because he can say anything at this point. Hmm. So now the other thing he did was, he says he escaped being executed at Buchenwald, which was another lie, because they weren't executing people at Buchenwald, particularly in 1944. But anyway, he says, he did this by exchanging identities with a prisoner who had died of typhus. This is a common story. And, it's true that at the end of the war, you know, late 1944, there was more opportunity for there to be confusion and to exchange identities, but it wasn't that easy. But he said that, also he later escaped from Dora during a transfer to the Bergen-Belsen death camp. You know, yeah, so here he has an escape. You know, he was waterboarded, then he escaped being executed. And then he escaped while he was being transferred to Bergen-Belsen. He fled from his German guards, you know, and then he met advancing American troops in Hamburg. Well, that must have been May already, if he was meeting them in Hamburg. So, you know, this guy is to my mind, from what I know about him, you know, he's just telling stories. So here we find a pure liar when he has the opportunity to do so and to create, you know, stories that would have some small effect on history, on how we see our history and how we see our reality. And, but here's the thing that I discovered was that when I went looking for the source of these stories that he told, you know, they all came from the New York Times article in 2011 by Elaine Ciolino, titled A Resistance Hero Fires Up the French. And every reference on that Wikipedia page is from 2011 or 12. Every one of them. So there's nothing from earlier, you know?
Right.
So after he became well known with this pamphlet and they asked him about the war,
he needed a good story.
He made up all this stuff, you know? Uh-huh. And so I say he's like Dennis Abbey, another one who in his 90s who decided to tell about his heroic
past.
Reminds
me a little bit of Elie Wiesel.
Yeah, well, everything reminds people of, but Elie Wiesel started a lot younger.
Well, yeah, he had a much earlier start.
Now at this a little bit more about this guy. After the war, of course, his side won, and they were all doing their thing. And he was friends with René Cassin, president of the Alliance Israelite Universelle, from 1943 to 1976. You know, that's a long time to be president, 43 to 76. And Cremieux was president for a long time, too, until he died. And I think with this organization, once they make you president, you're in there until you die, something like that.
Of course, he was much earlier. He was 19th century.
Yeah. But I don't know who was in between, but I know this guy was from 43 to 76. And he also was a winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1968, this Cassin. And I think, I don't know what he did beyond that he was one of the founders, except he was one of these Jews, you know, who they promoted. But he was one of the founders, and I think the, one of the main founders of the... Oh, I just jumped my place here. Main founders of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you know, adopted for the United Nations General Assembly in 1948. And one of the other founders was Stephen Hessel. But there were a number of them, but there wasn't a huge number. But there was, you know, he was one of them. And Eleanor Roosevelt, of course, was among this group and very dominant in it. But so was this Cassin. He's much more famous than Hessel. So that's our Stephen Hessel. You know, as I already said, he's added his part to the manufactured reality of extreme Jewish suffering under the National Socialist government. But I would say you can disregard anything he has said. But he, since he just died, you know, he came up in the news and it brought him to my attention. Well, later on, listeners, and our listeners are growing. That's nice. Later on, I want to talk about Jewish photographer Robert Capa. But for now, as I said, Harlan, what have you got on the way of, in the way of major deceptions that you want to talk about?
Well, I've been taking a look at the Jesus didn't exist theory, which is being, seems like it's being promoted in increasing force and frequency as time goes by. There are a couple of documentary films in particular that present this, I don't know what to call it, theory, premise. I mean, they state it as if it's fact, but it has to be seen, of course, as a theory. This is the film Zeitgeist. I don't know if you, have you seen Zeitgeist?
You know, I have, but it's been a while. And, you know, I don't think it was Zeitgeist, but I got into that some years ago, five, six, seven, I don't know, based on a couple of websites I looked at that was on the astrological theory thing, you know, that it was the based on the thinking of the 12, the zodiac and the meaning of the 12 signs and so on. And then you have the 12 disciples and the sun, you know, Jesus, the sun in the center or Christ and the sun, S-U-N and S-O-N and the whole
thing. Well, that's the same thing. Like,
and, you know, and I also read some books about the historical Jesus. It would have been probably in 2003. And I was, I got convinced by those that there was no evidence whatsoever. And I decided to dismiss the whole thing. And I was carrying on even in some, online arguments, that way at that time. But, I don't know. I got past that and I don't really, it's not an important issue to me anymore. It was kind of then. But I know it is for so many people. So I want to hear what you have to say.
Well, anyway, so Zeitgeist. Well, Zeitgeist is, you know, interesting film in some ways. It, you know, it's about 9/11 and the money system. And
well, that's what I thought it was. Yeah, that's
right.
What I
thought. There's three parts to it.
Okay. All right. That's why.
Yeah. Part one is about religion. Part two, I forget what the order of the other two parts are. But one of them is about the money system, and then about 9/11.
Okay.
So it's, you know, I was involved for a while in the 9/11 truth movement, and this film made a big splash back in the day when it came out, which was, I don't know, back in the early, let's see, what does it say here? I'm on the wrong page. Well, anyway, in the early 2000-something, it came out, 2004 or 5, something like that. So it made a big splash, and a lot of people were talking about it. But the part one really kind of disturbed me. Because it not only sort of maps the same set of ideas that you just described, you know, with where they try to show that the Jesus story was invented as for the purpose of controlling and deceiving people, but it also then goes on into an attack on theism itself. So it's really an attack on the spirituality in a very profound sense, and it doesn't offer anything to replace it. which I also noticed. Then recently, there's another film that's come out called Caesar's Messiah, which basically tracks the same premise. I mean, it has a little different angle on it, but it tries to make the case that Jesus was invented by the Romans for the purpose of controlling their troublesome Jewish population. So they invented this pacifistic figure, as they call Jesus, to feed to the Jews so that they would so they wouldn't be so, caught up in their messianic rebellious tendencies. And it overlooks so many things that, it's hard to even begin to count them. But it overlooks the fact that the Christians were persecuted by the Romans for the first several hundred years of their existence. So that
just recently somebody came out with this. I saw it. It was just last week. Someone came out. Now I think it's a book. Yes, I know. Robert, is that his first name? Butts was sending it around. Butz, the revisionist. And it's a book by probably Jews says that Christians, somebody did this long study probably for a PhD or something, but mm-hmm. Christians were not persecuted. Somehow this shows that the idea that Christians were persecuted is another myth, another Christian myth, church myth.
Uh-huh. That's their answer for everything. Like,
yeah.
For example, there are several references to Jesus in Roman histories. But they say that was just all made up and inserted by Christians later.
Yeah, I read that.
Right, so that's their typical answer for anything that seems to point to the existence of early Christianity or Jesus. They say that it's just made up by Christians.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of take it or leave it, I suppose. But my main concern about this, all these theories, they all focus on the story about Jesus. And they do not ever talk about Jesus' actual teachings, which I think is what's significant about Jesus, is what he said. But they never talk about that. They only talk about his story, the patterns that you find in the Bible, the mythology that was introduced into the Jesus story by the church. And, it's apparent that was done to a large extent. The mythologies of Mithraism and even Judaism, like Jesus died for your sins, the atonement doctrine. That's just a carryover of, blood sacrifice from Judaism, because Paul, who was essentially the founder of Christianity, was a Jew. I mean, he converted, but he still brought a lot of Judaism into Christianity.
Well, what about people who say they are all Jews?
Well, they're Jews and Greeks.
Point out that Paul was a Jew,
Right.
They say that they were all Jews.
Well, and the gospel writers, the apostles,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whatever you choose to call them,
them,
of course, they were all Jewish.
I don't know. They were Galileans.
Well, Galileans, right. But, I mean, they were practicing the Jewish religion, whatever that makes them.
See,
I mean, the terminology here is very slippery. in terms of what is a Jew, who is a Jew, what does that term even mean? It has had so many different meanings over time that it's really hard to get a grasp on it. But there are also a lot of Greeks involved in early Christianity, Philo, mm-hmm. coming out of Greece. So in a sense, it was a merger of Greek philosophy, going back to the Plato and the Greek philosophers, and the teachings of Jesus, which brought in a whole new dimension of understanding about the nature of God. And that's the part that's never really talked about in these attempts to discredit the idea that Jesus even existed. So the way I see it, these theories are attempting to kind of cut the legs out from under Jesus so that whatever he said will not be carried with any significance. Well, at the same time, we don't actually look at what he said, if you see what I mean. And
I don't know, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm reminded of the a couple of passages, particularly from the protocols. We talked about the protocols a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And in the protocols, we find that it says we have long past taken care to discredit the priesthood of the Goyim, and thereby to ruin their mission on earth, which in these days might still be a great hindrance to us. Day by day, its influence on the peoples of the world is falling lower, so that now only years divide us from the moment of the complete wrecking of that Christian religion. As to other religions, we shall have still less difficulty in dealing with them. So, you know, it's spelled out here that their intention is to attack Christianity because they see it as their, in some ways, as the primary threat. There's the other passage where it says, it is indispensable for us to undermine all faith, to tear out of the minds of the Goyim the very principle of Godhead and the Spirit, and to put in its place arithmetical calculations and material needs. So I tend to see these efforts in that context. And I see it that way because of the importance, again, of the importance of some of the things that Jesus had to say. Because he talks about God as Spirit. And that the kingdom of heaven, or the kingdom of God, is within you. So he's talking about inner values and inner perception of spirit reality. The way I think about these things, the dynamic processes of reality are usually governed by triad relationships. Like if you think about music, for example, it has rhythm, harmony, and melody. There's three things that go together to create a dynamic system. You know, if you only have two things, you have a static structure.
Oh, yeah, like a three-legged stool comes to my mind. You can't have a two-legged stool or
right.
It won't be stable. Three-legged
right.
stools are stable.
Right, exactly. So, going back to the Greeks, there was this understanding of reality that we have three levels of understanding. We have facts about material things. We have meanings, which are grasped in the mind, and then we also perceive values, which are perceived through the spirit. So this fact, meaning, and value sets up a dynamic system.
Mm-hmm.
So those three realms of understanding reality are represented by science, philosophy, and religion, you know, classically in terms of that way of understanding things.
Mm-hmm.
So the individual in this from this perspective is called upon to be all three of those things. So this war that goes on between science and religion and the media, you know, is kind of a sham because they're always trying to, you know, as if one is going to win over the other. You know, it really makes no sense. You know, I think as an individual, each one of us is called upon to be a scientist, a philosopher, and a religionist. You know, personally, just in our own personal grasp and view of reality, we need all three of those perspectives to get a full picture.
Mm-hmm.
So the attempt to discredit religion ends up being, in effect, an attempt to take values away from us and to do what it says in the protocols, which is to leave us with nothing but arithmetical calculations.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, perception of value.
Translate arithmetical evaluations? I mean, I think that means numbers like money or something. You know, like it reverts back to just material things.
Right, just
what do they mean
the material
by that?
Thing. Yeah, that's what it says. That's the rest of that passage. It says to put in the place of Godhead and Spirit, put in its place arithmetical calculations and material needs. So we're always, you know, it's materialism. Just give people.
Well, the arithmetic would be adding up, you know.
You have to add up your money in order to buy things.
And also just the pro and con, how good will this be for me? How good will it not be? And stuff like that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. So, and then of course we have Rakovsky, where he says, in reality, Christianity is our only real enemy. I mean, speaking for, you know, from the perspective of Jewish Bolsheviks.
Mm-hmm.
And we know what the Bolsheviks did to Christianity as soon
right.
as they got power. You know, they went and they were bulldozing churches and parading priests through the streets and, you know, torturing them and executing them and killing millions and millions.
It's true. They did.
Right, so they did all that. So that was a direct physical attack on Christianity. They're trying to eradicate Christianity. Mm-hmm. And then Rutkowski says in 1938, in reality, Christianity is our only real enemy, speaking from the perspective of, you know, like Talmudic Judaism, translated into Bolshevism at the time. Christianity, controlling the individual, is capable of annulling the revolutionary projection of the neutral Soviet or atheistic state by choking it. And as we see in Russia, this obstacle has not yet been removed during 20 years of Marxism. So there's something very enduring about the individual desire for spirit, which, you know, makes total sense. I mean, how could it be any other way? It's mm-hmm. not enough to just have a body and a mind. We also have a spirit, because that's where love comes from. That's where our perception of values, like truth and beauty and goodness, that's all in the spirit realm. You know, that doesn't come directly out of mind or the body. I mean, it takes all three to create a total human being. I mean, as far as I'm, you know, mm-hmm. as I understand it, at least. So there's this constant attempt to take away.
How do you distinguish spirit from mind?
It has to do with values as opposed to meanings.
Okay, meanings are in the mind and values are in the spirit.
Values are in the spirit, yes.
Okay.
And of course, this all goes along with the idea that we're more than just physical.
Which, well, sure.
I mean, it seems obvious.
Well,
to
I
me.
Know that. I always knew that.
Right.
Because I could always feel, I always felt the spiritual in myself. You know, I always felt this stuff in myself, you know, communicating with myself and so on. It wasn't mental.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, the thing about values is that values are felt.
Yeah, I mean, the feeling is so important. What we feel is the most important and the most powerful energy that we have, the most powerful
yes.
force that we have comes from feeling. We
That's
can't
we
just
our...
be feeling people and nothing, no mind, but the,
yeah.
Yeah, but
That's where we get our convictions.
Yeah.
You know, our sense of what's right.
And we also get the power. I mean, there's power. In that. Power that
yeah.
goes out into the world and affects things the way our, you know, accordingly.
Yeah, in a transformative way. That's where the power of transformation comes from.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
By having an inner vision, you know, the values are grasped first on the inside as a feeling, and then they're translated into the outer world. So if you're trying to control people and suppress their creative urges, the first place you're going to attack is the realm of spirit, which is exactly the strategy we read about in the protocols. And that Rutkowski is talking about.
Yeah.
So when these films come out using these pretty spurious evidence to try to convince us that Jesus didn't exist, the way I feel that, or the way I see that in my mind, is they're trying to take Jesus away from us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked myself, well, why are they trying to take Jesus away from us? Why is that so important to these people? And it has to do with control. Now, they say just the opposite. Like in Zeitgeist, they say that they blame, of course, theism for everything bad that's ever happened under the sun.
Right.
But they say that theistic religion is the trademark. No, he says division is the trademark of all theistic religions. So, as if to say that all human conflict is the result of theistic religion, and that's a pretty extreme statement.
What do they recommend instead, or they don't?
Well, they don't. They don't recommend anything.
Okay.
That's just it. Well, they say, oh, we're all one. You know, so if we could just somehow feel that we're all one, then everything would be nice. We could go have a picnic or something.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, we're not all one. There's all kinds of conflict going on.
Mm-hmm.
So we need something else to give us higher vision, higher insight, you know, something that can enlighten our minds with new visions of possibility. And that's where all good things come from. So whatever it is that, you know, we're trying to do in the world, you know, to make the world more supportive of our best goals has to be supported by an inner vision. And
But back to the deception. Did you? This is Jews behind this.
Where this really gets interesting to me is that this all ties in with the attack on National Socialism.
Okay.
Because National Socialism was based on exactly these ideas. As a matter of fact, National Socialism was probably the biggest threat that's come along in a long time to those who would kill the spirit in us. Because it was based on a profound inner spiritual life. That was the whole premise of National Socialism.
Okay, explain that, because you don't hear too many people saying that.
Well, I posted a couple things on my blog that might be interesting to look at. And
on your new one?
My new one.
Camels?
That's the Gnats and Camels.
Oh, I see. When did you post something, like today? Or
just today, yeah.
Okay, I haven't looked at that. All right. Well, people can go there. Give them that. It's easy enough.
Gnats, so that's Gnats and Camels, just all run together, .wordpress.com.
Yeah. Okay.
So I don't have much on here. I've got some comments about Zeitgeist and then some more thoughts about religion along the lines of what we've been talking about. But in terms of what I just brought up, I have posted some excerpts from the memoirs of Otto Wagner.
Okay.
And then also some excerpts from the NSDAP handbook from 1943. And both of these documents have very surprising and interesting material in them, in terms of these questions. At least I think. In the Revelations, this piece I call Revelations from the Memoirs of Otto Wagner, there's several different sections of his recording of what Hitler was, had to say about various.
And I want to just repeat again that I have that book, Memoirs of Otto Wagner. A wonderful person recommended it to me one time, and it sounded so good, so I ordered it. Boy, am I glad! I thought it was just great. It is.
It's very interesting.
Book. Yeah.
It's a great. It's a great companion to the Jesus That I Knew. The accounts from his childhood friend?
I don't know that one.
I remember you. Well, I heard about it from you. You recommended it on one of your shows.
Jesus That I Knew?
No. Hitler That I Knew. Sorry.
Yeah. By his friend. Right.
His friend from when he was a teenager.
I can't think of it right now. I've got the book over there in a big pile, but.
Right.
Yes. Okay.
But they tie together, which.
Yeah, they do go
to me
well
speaks to the authenticity of both.
Uh-huh. I like that other one very much, too, by his friend. I thought it was just great. I've always spoken real well of it.
Right. So one of these...
Great stuff you got here.
So in my excerpts from Otto Wagner, I added these little section headings, topical, just to identify the topics that he was talking about. Mm-hmm. And the first one at the top, he's talking about socialism as an inner conversion. He says it's a transformation. We were just talking about transformation. So transformation requires an inner conversion, a mental, spiritual, and ethical, and even a religious one. So there's a reach here for the highest possible values. Let's see. It says that... talking about this, this inner conversion. He says you will realize that a new faith is awakening out of the lethargy of a corrupt epoch. Faith in divine justice and heavenly truth, the faith in an unworldly, paradisiacal future where the lust for power, force, and enmity gives way to equality and fraternity, the spirit of sacrifice, love, and loyalty, and the will to stand before the throne of the Almighty with the open heart of one ready to believe in God. He's talking about the youth.
This isn't Hitler speaking, right?
Yes, this is Hitler speaking.
Oh, okay. All right, because I'm not... I just found it now. Okay, where you are.
Yeah, it's that first one.
And what was he speaking about? Why was
He's talking about the youth. He's talking about National Socialism.
Yeah.
See, now, the interesting thing about National Socialism, I've seen several places now where it's referred to as a confession. You know that
I don't know.
Confession.
Yeah, well, and they use that a lot in Germany and in Protestantism and the
usually it refers to some type of religious faith.
Well, because they wanted the confession of the German Christian Church. That was a different kind of confession. But that it refers to what church group you belong to.
Well, it typically refers to that. But they're moving it over to refer to National Socialism.
Okay, now let's remember that this book was written by Otto Wagner as he remembered it. And when he was in detention or prison or something after the war.
Right.
And he sat down.
British.
Yeah, and he decided to write, to put it all together, everything he remembered. And I think he's a very smart man, and I think he did a good job, because Hitler made a big, powerful impression on him, and
I think
he probably put it together as best he can.
Explained that in my little introduction here.
Yeah,
He reconstructed his diary.
We can't say that these are actually Adolf Hitler's words, but they're the words as he recalls them.
As best recalled by Otto Wagner.
Yeah, yeah. So generally, it would be something like this, because he did. He did recall an awful lot of conversation from Hitler that he put in that book. And, even though it sounds real good, you do have to kind of wonder.
You have to understand it from that perspective, right?
Yeah, right.
But it checks out, though. It matches up with other things I've been reading about National Socialism, particularly this handbook, from the National Socialist Party. We see very similar thinking.
Right.
But anyway, the editor, as I note in the little introduction here, says that instances where checks could be made, Wagner's memory proved highly reliable. Obviously, Wagner was a man of unusual memory who had an eye and ear for details. He was also accustomed, as one might expect, of a former general staff officer to writing down his observations in extensive and precise form. So they explain that he created the original diary, he created it, at the time. So he was always having these long conversations with Hitler, and not always just with Wagner. Sometimes other people were present. But these conversations were sort of Hitler's preferred form for working out policy.
Mm-hmm.
They'd all sit around, they'd talk, and they'd come up, he would just come up extemporaneously with these, amazing thought constructs about possibility.
And so where are we going here with this, with how this fits into the...
The next section, there's a section here called I call Christianity and the Teachings of Jesus.
Okay, got it.
So he goes on at length about his perception of all that. And what I find interesting about it is that he separates Jesus from Christianity. He understands that Jesus taught... I mean, Jesus didn't start Christianity. It was started by his followers after his death. So he's able to separate the two.
Which
but
how does he know what Jesus taught? I mean, it's only according to what...
Well, it's recorded, as recorded.
In there. Yeah, I mean, you have to...
As recorded by the, the early followers.
Yeah.
And then particularly in the four Gospels.
Mm-hmm. And you have to find what seems to be most important there.
Right. So, you have to look at that with the eye of the Spirit and look for what's consistent in nature in the statements that are attributed to Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
I recently heard a lecture by a Christian guy, but he was talking about new current research that's been done on the demographics and the naming frequency in Palestine during the time when Jesus is said to have lived, and a lot of details about the place names, even the botany and the biology, all these little references that come up in the gospel accounts, and they all match up. They all, they all come out to match what is actually known now about that period. So one of the more interesting ones is the naming frequency and the use of double names. Like Simon was one of the most popular names. So if your name was Simon, you were called Simon something, like Simon Peter or some way to identify you from all the other Simons. So all the double names in the Gospels all match up with high-frequency names, as they've been able to determine, you know, based on current research of that period. And there's a bunch of other little things like that, like the, I don't want to go into all those details.
No, but it was
very interesting, though, because what they found was that the Gospels that were written later, you know, like the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Judas, so some other ones that have turned up later, do not have any of that. They don't have, you know, they may only have one or two names, and they don't have any details. They're just statements. But the four.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And anyway, all of this just argues for the fact that whoever wrote the Gospels had been there, because they got the details right.
You know, you're going to find people who are going to argue with that, and they'll come up with something too. But
well, yeah, there's always people who argue things, but it's up to us to decide, well, which argument makes more sense.
Well, that's right. That's what it's all about, really. And you
I don't discount something just because somebody argues against it.
Yeah, no.
Necessarily. Right. I mean, if they make a good argument, then yeah. But
it's hard to find any real proof. It's all based on where you want to come down on this, in large part, because, you know, I don't think there's too much proof one way or the other. But Wagner was a socialist, much more of a pure socialist than Hitler, mm-hmm. because Hitler was trying to be, you know, run a nation. Well, he just wasn't that. He liked socialism, but Wagner was more sympathetic to the Russian socialists too. You know,
that comes up to the
Bolsheviks and so on, and somehow working things out. He wanted to have good relations with the mm-hmm. Soviet Union, and Hitler didn't want to. And Wagner was very suspicious and didn't like the British, and Hitler kept telling him that he was determined that had to be the way it went. There's no other way to do it. They had to have alliance with the British, which of course was never possible. But
right, he tried.
But Wagner then would have had more of a sense of Christian socialism with the, you know, about the what mm-hmm. the Third Reich would be, or you know, when Hitler came into power, mm-hmm. he was convinced Hitler would come into power. Then probably Hitler did. So I can understand him putting a lot of emphasis on this in his book. But it's not on Christianity.
That's what I find so interesting about it. It's not on Christianity. It's about the teachings of Jesus. Here he has Hitler saying, through us alone and not until now do these teachings celebrate their resurrection. Mary Magdalene stood at the empty tomb, for they were seeking the dead man, but we intend to raise the treasures of the living Christ. Herein lies the essential element of our mission. We must bring back to the German folk the recognition of those teachings. Mm-hmm. And then he goes on about how, you know, Christianity had corrupted them.
Well, you know, he probably would have said all these things. And I know that Hitler spent hours and hours and hours talking, speaking out loud to the people around him. And the people thought it was so brilliant, and it was. They mm-hmm. were astounded. That's why they finally started writing it down.
Right.
But
the interesting thing
as you said, he was working out his ideas, and so he went off into a lot of areas that mm-hmm. may not be, you know, the real kernel of his thinking. You know,
I don't know. In some ways, it seems that they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things from the Hitler that I knew, that, you know, the picture at least I get from Hitler from that, is he was always looking for total solutions. I mean, he never spent any time doing anything else. You know, like when they moved to Vienna, right away he was like redesigning Vienna mm-hmm. after having already redesigned the town he was from.
Linz.
Yeah, right. But he had a mind that was just went into all dimensions. You know, to find
I agree with you 100%.
A total solution.
Let's go back to what this has to do about the deception and where mm-hmm. you started with, what they're trying to destroy in people's minds, that Jesus was a real person and Jesus existed.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's not just Jesus. It's just the inner life in general that's based on spirit. I mean, that's the way I see it. It's an attack on spirit. And, of course, since Jesus was a teacher of spirit, then he gets, you know, the first hit. But it's more than just that.
So you're saying that we need to keep alive the idea of Jesus as a teacher and
or
study
at
his
least
teachings.
Look at what he had to say.
Yeah, yeah. Study his teachings and without that we're going to be, you know, a lot is being stolen from us.
Yeah, that's the idea. Yeah, when he says the kingdom of God is within you, you know, he said, you know, a knock and the door shall be opened. You know, he's talking about the inner life.
And you think that the Jews want to take this away from us?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, they've always hated Jesus. I mean, that's another thing that sort of gives away that Jesus didn't exist theory, is because the Jews have been obsessed with Jesus. You know, the Talmud is full of references to Jesus.
You're right. That's a very good point, of course, because they're constantly saying what it, you know.
Yeah, you know, and the whole, you know, blood libel thing, or the blood Passover thing that we talked about, all those rituals are anti-Jesus. You know, they take a Christian child and use the child as a representative of, you know, as a symbolic of Jesus, and then they kill him and torture him and drain his blood. I mean, that shows how much they hate Jesus. You know, they wouldn't have that kind of hatred for Jesus if he was somebody that never existed. I mean, they saw him as a betrayer because, you know, they were looking for their, you know, Messiah to sit on the throne of David and beat up the...
Well, that's true. So we can say that while they try to tell us on one hand that Jesus didn't exist, they really believe that he did, and they're trying to destroy our belief in him.
Yeah, right, or, exactly. That's the idea.
Of course,
idea.
You know, belief in Jesus is very powerful for people because you're not just believing in an idea or a religious idea, but you're believing in a person.
Well, you're also discovering a connection to God within yourself. That's
but
important.
You can discover that connection to God without...
you can, sure. Yeah, it's not dependent on that, but Jesus...
And there were religions. See, a lot of people will say that what Jesus was teaching was not new to him. He didn't invent it.
There's a lineage going back into... Well, that's the other interesting thing. If you look in the Old Testament, to my reading, there's two different God concepts. You know, there's the God concept of the prophet, you know, who talk about a righteous God. And then there's the books of Moses, where they're talking about this, you know, God that, you know, tells you to go out and massacre all your neighbors and leaving nothing alive. Yeah, they're not of the same character at all. Not even close. So this conflict has a long, deep history that goes back into the period. You know, like the books of Moses were first, I think Deuteronomy was first read in the Temple of Jerusalem, something like 600 BC. And then the other four books of the Torah, the books of Moses were produced during the captivity, which followed shortly after that. But the more that the priests, and this is the Levites, by the way, the Levite priesthood are the ones that cooked all this up. And there was this battle going on between the Jewish people and their priesthood. So, the prophets, what are referred to as the prophets in the Old Testament, like Isaiah and others, they were trying to maintain the spirit concept of God, which is what Jesus also taught. Meanwhile, the priesthood was insisting on all these blood rituals and temple taxation. It was very oppressive.
Well,
so there's this conflict going on. And this same conflict appears to me that continues on to this day. So when we read in the protocols about, you know, the importance of taking spirit away from people, it's the same thing that the Levite priests were doing to the Jewish people back, you know, 600 BC. There's a continuation of that agenda.
So what do you say to the idea of Jesus Jesus' racial identity? Jesus was a Jew, as far as you're concerned?
Well, he's Galilean.
Well, yeah, but what does that mean to you? I mean, you accept that they were all Jewish.
Well, they were, you know, he grew up in a household that was practicing the Jewish religion.
Mm-hmm.
At least according to the story we have. That, you know,
well,
that,
you. I mean,
the,
I know
that was the culture. That was the culture he grew up in, but he transcended that.
Well, the question is, can we believe the story that we're told? You know, that's where we started.
Right.
Can we believe that story? And what does it mean? And who was Jesus really? And of course, you know, in this, in the truth, well, what we're dealing with here, or what I'm dealing with, is people saying, since Jesus was a practicing Jew and all these early Christians were Jews and it was religion that came out of Judaism, it's not the right religion.
But the priesthood put him to death. I mean, he was a rebel.
So are you distinguishing between the priesthood and the better Jews, the more spiritually minded Jews?
I suppose you could put it that way. Yeah. I mean, it's clear that there was a war
going
on.
So that you're not seeing Jewishness as a genetic...
it is. It particularly became that. It's become that, you know, increasingly over time, because that's, you know, the mating practices of Jews is you know, by law in the Talmud. You know, they're not allowed to, you know, if you're a true Jew, you don't marry outside. So it creates an inbred gene pool. You know, Kevin McDonald's written about this. Other people have written about this.
Well,
so
right.
It's eugenics, essentially.
Well, sum up, what is your final sum up of this? What do you want people to get from all this?
Well,
we only got a few seconds.
Okay. Well, we could, the other post that I put up, these passages from the handbook, the National Socialist Handbook, look at this from a similar perspective, where they talk about the importance of the balancing the inner life with the community, creating an inner unity that is reflected in an outer community.
Okay, well, we're going to come back, ladies and gentlemen, after a five-minute musical interlude, and this is, again, Frank Reneke singing Helden Gedenken. See you in a bit.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten, und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken, im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken, und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie keinen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit!
Oh, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager. And tonight is the 150th Heretics Hour program. And it is the three-year anniversary of the Heretics Hour, which started on March 1st, 2010, the first program. And my guest tonight is Harlan Schulke. And we've been having a discussion here, or he's been leading it, about religion. Now, Harlan, you know, I thought I thought that this was going to kind of go around the idea that of deceptions, you know, major deceptions. And
well, major
I thought
deception
that from your...
is everything we've been told about National Socialism. That's the big deception in this case.
Oh, I thought it was about, you know,
I mean,
that we've been told that Jesus didn't exist, and that was...
Well, that ties in with it. That's part of it.
Okay.
Part of the same.
So why don't you take the next... 10-15 minutes and talk about this the book. Is this at the handling of racial differences within a Volt community? Is that where it starts, or is somewhere else?
Oh, that's more Wagner. Go down a little farther.
Oh, that's more Wagner. Go down to.
Actually, it's the most recent post. It's one excerpts from Ich Kampf, I Fight.
The most recent. Oh, at the top. Oh, okay.
At the top, yes.
All right. No wonder we're going up at the top. All right, why don't you say what you want about this and see how we can tie this in.
Okay.
There's some kind of idea about deception.
Right. So I've been looking at 1984 again recently, just for the heck of it, and I found this passage where it says, the ideal set up by the party was something huge, terrible, and glittering, a world of steel and concrete, of monstrous machines and terrifying weapons. A nation of warriors and fanatics marching forward in perfect unity, all thinking the same thoughts and shouting the same slogans, perpetually working, fighting, triumphing, persecuting, 300 million people with the same face. So that, to me, is almost a perfect description of what we're usually told about National Socialism. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the sort of the Hollywood picture of what National Socialism produced and was about. But that... you know, from what I'm learning, is a huge deception, because it wasn't that at all, by any means. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's much evidence for that. But this handbook talks about what their goals were, what they were trying to do with National Socialism, with this, and the idea of the Weltanschauung, I'm not even sure how to pronounce it.
Yeah, Weltanschauung.
But that's this a key concept.
You have this. You must have a copy of this. I Fight, because I don't
this
think
book.
It's
yes,
online.
Yes, I do. Uh huh.
Good for you. Where'd you get it?
Well, I got it. I forget where I got it. I either got it from maybe Barnes Review or from IHR.
Oh, I'm gonna get one if they're available.
I got it from somewhere. Somebody has taken and actually made a complete facsimile of the original book. So the whole thing is it's all there in German with all the original photographs and everything.
Yeah, and then it's translated into English.
And then at the back, there's the English translation.
Okay.
So, you know, it's like any translation, it's a translation. So, you don't really know. I mean, I assume that the person who did it did the best they could.
Yeah.
And one of the points he makes is that this concept of the Weltanschauung is not, doesn't have an English, there's nothing, there's no English word equivalent to it.
No,
and the only
right.
way you can really understand what they meant by it is to read it in context. And from that, pick up a sense or a feeling of what it was about. So one of the most interesting articles in here is by Alfred Rosenberg.
Mm-hmm.
And it's titled Internal and External Freedom. And so I've got some excerpts from that here in this post.
Yeah, well, just talk about them rather than read them.
But, right. No, I'm not going to read it. But what okay. he... Well, just one thing he says. He says that in his view, a Weltanschauung is a view that creates an inner unity in all fields of life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's...
Well, I think that would be because you see from a certain perspective or in a certain way. Again, the words are hard to come up with. But but you see everything from that perspective
right.
in that place. And therefore, that unifies everything that you see in some, you know, I mean... That's,
right.
that's the unifying principle.
But it's unity that's not achieved through uniformity, like in that
right.
passage from 1984. You know, everybody has the same face.
Mm-hmm.
That
right.
that wasn't the approach. They're trying to find a third way. So they're looking at the history of Europe and noticing that it seems like the only two alternatives are tyranny and chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this insight that they're so excited about is that they've come upon a third way that allows for the freedom of the inner freedom of the individual at the same time as there's this unity in the community.
Well, this is not something they just discovered. I mean, this is something that's been evolving or
yeah.
developing in amongst German.
Right. No, and he talks about that. Right.
Yeah,
now he points
right.
back to earlier understanding.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean
but,
to say that.
And I guess the tyranny versus chaos is more of a communist idea.
On the one hand, yeah, in some ways, maybe it's both, but right. So there's
well,
both
I mean, you know, that they say, well, if we don't want chaos, so we have to have this tyranny. You know, everybody has to do what they're told.
Right.
But you're saying, and others have said that this is not was not what German National Socialism was about.
Right. Exactly. It was a third path, and it's based on this understanding of the importance of the inner life. And the importance of inner freedom, which is the same thing that Jesus was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I see a big connection.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that's worth fighting for.
And when they talked about inner life, they didn't mean that people were going to be sitting around in meditation.
No.
Like Buddhism or something.
No, they're talking about
that.
The inner perception of values.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also talking about the uniqueness of each individual. So in the genetic pool of Germany, you have all these millions of people, but everyone's different, and everyone has something different to offer. And so they're designing their educational system to bring the best out in each individual, so that individual personality was celebrated in a sense, but dedicated to the good of the community.
Yeah, so it wasn't individualism as we tend to think of it now, or people would
right,
interpret
as an end in itself.
It wasn't not individualism, and Hitler always was saying that the good of the nation or the good of the collective. He didn't use the word collective too much, I don't think. Of course, he used whatever German words were, but the good of the group, the good of the people.
Of the whole.
The whole.
The community.
Was way dominant over the interests of the individual.
Well,
so
they were in balance. They were in balance. It didn't step on the individual and force the individual to do anything. It cultivated the individual.
Yeah, that's good. You know, and it says that first people were given freedom to learn and become, you know, discover who they were and develop their talents and abilities.
Right.
And then they used them in a dutiful way to the good of the whole, and this is what was expected, and this was something that people they
but
felt
it was also very,
to do, but wanted
very
to
exciting for the individuals to be given
yeah.
that opportunity.
Right, right,
and that's why it took off the way it did, from what I can tell. I mean, it was amazing what happened in such a short period of time in the early 30s. You know, going from all that unemployment to full employment and prosperity. You know, when you look at Triumph of the Will, you know, with Hitler's entry into Nuremberg, you know, and the looks of the faces of the people, you know, they're so excited. They're so happy. You know, there's something has been released there. This creative force has finally been given an opportunity to happen. And it's, and the way I see that is it's this unification of the inner life with the outer world so that they can work together.
So people don't understand that Hitler really did have a close connection with Jesus in his mind and the Christian message, you might say. And yet, you know, he put it together in a political way with socialism and nationalism. And were there by not wanting this to return, our enemies don't want this to return, and they want to destroy Christianity too, and they want, and you don't think too much of that, but they want to destroy the belief in Jesus as an as what as kind of an individual who had a message.
Right, because
put that in your own words.
Yeah, well, if you can, you know, convince people that Jesus never existed, then you won't pay any attention to what he said. So it takes away his spiritual message.
Okay.
That's,
and that,
you know,
would be a big
and
loss.
And I see that as a tremendous loss, yes. So if we look at National Socialism, we can see the potential that was born from that.
Okay. Well, that's,
you know,
really good.
He didn't just come out of nowhere. What's that?
I said that's very good the way you tied that in, and you could still do more, I know, and I think this is great what you've got posted here. I mean, this is great on this page here. I'm sure people are going to be very interested in reading it, and I'm going to read it too. But in this, then, would you say that this is, I won't call it a conspiracy, but this is a purposeful act that our enemies are carrying out, and who are the enemies?
Well, we read their words, so we can kind of work back from that. You know, when Murkowski says that Germany has to be destroyed and gives the reasons why it has to be destroyed, and he gives three reasons, you know, the planning for World War II that was being set up in 1938 had to be destroyed, first of all, because they figured out the secret about money. You know, they were creating prosperity on their own through generating their own currency and not borrowing from the private bankers. So that was one reason. You know, the other reason was the Christianity was the spirit that was, you know, alive in these people. And then third was the nationalism, the destruction of nationalism. So all these three things are all, you know, big obstacles to the what Murkowski would refer to as the permanent revolution, which is the destruction of everything that's good and worthwhile in the world.
Well, I'm thinking of Murkowski as this Russian. Is that who he was?
Yeah, but he's Jewish. You know, he's a Jewish
Talmudic
Jew. You know, so that's all. But that's always been the agenda of Talmudic Judaism, is to destroy. I mean, that's what you read going clear back to Deuteronomy. It's destroy, 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 destroy. That's what it's all about. Deliver their kings into thine hands, and thou shalt destroy their name from under heaven. I will put the dread of thee and the fear of thee upon the nations under the whole heaven. Shall hear reports of thee, and shall tremble and be in anguish because of thee. You know, thee being the Jews.
Yeah. Well, I think you've offered something very interesting here. It finally all came together for me, and I thank you for that. I would like to now go to the some of these photographic deceptions that I sort of promised, and we can always. But I thought that was all very good. Robert Capa is someone who somebody sent me a, and I sent you these links.
Somebody sent these to me.
And
I remember I've seen that image a number of times. That famous image.
I had never even seen it that I recall, and I really looked up a lot about him, and I find it again very interesting. It's always the same story, you know, in different, you know, different little bit of variety, but I want to tell people that the best page to go to see some information about this photograph that I'm going to talk about first is at the Daily Mail, and it's a real long URL, but I found that if you let me get rid of this and let me go to this. I put in Robert Capa. You have to add Daily Mail. Robert Capa, fake photograph, 2009 or something like that, but Daily Mail. And what I got on Google, it was the last one on the first page to the Daily Mail article, which is titled Faking Soldier, the photographic, got this only halfway here, the photographic evidence that Capa's camera does lie and that his iconic falling soldier was staged. And on this article from the Daily Mail, you know, they're a real terrible paper, but they use a lot of big photographs. They're kind of like sensational type, you know, tabloids. And mm-hmm. There's some great photographs here. Did you find it?
Let's see.
I'm looking for it maybe, but it's at the Mail Online. It's from 2009 July. Yeah, I've got the link here, but I can't give it to the listeners. It's too long. But if they go, they can see it. It's this photograph where supposedly this is during the Spanish Civil War, and supposedly one of the Republicans, that is the anti-Franco forces, was just shot on some hillside, and this Capa shot this photograph of him falling down.
In his dying moment.
Yeah. His rifle is just kind of coming out from his hand. He's lost his grip. He's lost his footing. He's looks like he's sitting, but there's nothing underneath his rear end. So he's in the pose of falling.
Right.
And
he's got his rifle off to one side.
Very famous. And
iconic.
They even came up with the person's name, his name, later on, which is supposedly now not true, because they studied. If you're at this site, you can see. I don't know.
You also sent me the link to the New York Times article about the same thing.
Yeah, but it doesn't have all the photographs.
It has a couple. It's three different photographs.
But this one is better. It's got the. It shows exactly how. How they proved, and it is proven, that where they said this took place didn't take place there. First, it was supposed to be, they don't give you much information here. Anyway, I might have it written down here.
You're at the Guardian, the Guardian article.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can see all these background sites that match this place.
Right, it's not the place where they said it was.
Where they said it was. So
right.
There was no war going on there. So the whole idea is that this man wasn't shot. He maybe lost his footing and was falling down, and he took this picture of him, or maybe he
was just staged
or something, you know. But it wasn't taken in battle. Yeah, here it is. It was supposed to be at Cerro Muriano, that's where Capo was, and that's where fighting was going on, but it was actually they were taken 30 miles away at Espejo, which was an open area, and Cerro Muriano was a more wooded area. And anyway, then below that you see this guy's ugly Jewish face, Capa. Now let me tell you the story about him. He was born in 1913 as Andre, because this is the way they lie about everything. Andre Friedman in Budapest, Hungary, to Dejo Friedman in Juliana Berkowitz, and they're, you know, all Jews. And Friedman, I don't know where he was. I don't know where they were, but he met this woman named Goethe Hoforil, and, In 1934, he was still calling himself Andre Friedman. See, he was born in 1913, so he was trying to, you know, be a photographer. He was a he had learned photography, and he's a pretty good photographer. Now, I'm not saying he wasn't. And and he met this Gerda Porfiril, and she was a, they call her a German-Jewish refugee. Well, she was a German-born Jew, maybe. She was a Jew living in Germany. And, you know, in 1934, there were no Jewish refugees. They call themselves refugees because they left Germany. But they weren't, you know, they weren't forced out. They weren't kicked out in 1934. They were being, you know, Hitler was in power then, and a lot of Jews didn't like what it, how things looked, and so they left. And that's what she did. And I just really, you know, this is just the way they write these things all the time. Make right. out that these people are more persecuted than they were. And they lived in Paris, the two of them, and Andre taught Gerda photography. And together, they decided to create this image of him as Robert Capa, a famous American photographer. You know, he wasn't American.
That was all a construct.
Yeah, he was Hungarian Jew, and she was a Jew too, German, Jew from Germany. And but they decided to reinvent him as a famous American photographer, picked out the name Robert Capa. And so then she took the name Gerda Taro and became successful in her own right, sort of. And so while they went to Spain to in 1936 to cover the, you know, the Spanish Civil War. Of course, you know what side they were on. And they wanted to document it. And in July 1937, he went made a brief trip to Paris. It was supposed to be brief, but she stayed in Madrid. And while he was gone, she was killed near Brunette during a battle. So she must have gone out to try to cover a fight and take some pictures and so on. She was killed. So supposedly he was engaged to her, and he was deeply shocked and never married. But here's the thing. It turns out that it's, I don't know how well proven it is. Some Japanese, I don't know if it was male or female, named Kotaro Sawaki, probably a man, did an investigation of all of this, very painstaking, detailed, etc., it supposedly was. And he presented a compelling case that Gerda Taro was the real photographer of this picture. That she took the picture, and that after she died, he claimed, or maybe before she died, I don't know, he claimed that it was his. So this is how bad these people can be.
But they were working sort of together, right?
Yeah, but, you know, he didn't want to give her credit for it. It says that he became famous for this picture.
Yeah.
Let's see, and that's just a bunch of stuff. Oh, yeah, somebody later, Spanish historian, how people join in with these things. A Spanish historian later identified the dead soldier as Federico Borrell Garcia, but this identification has been disputed now, and that this thing by this Japanese, this investigation by the Japanese says that Kappa wasn't there and that this is where she was and so on. And then then it also has come out that it's not even a dying soldier, and they're absolutely sure of that because of the place where it took place, and there was no fighting. And then somebody was saying, well, he was shot by a sniper, but they said there were no snipers.
They didn't have any snipers,
there.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, one thing after another. So really the facts show that they lied about this whole thing. And here you've got this photograph, just like so many, that becomes so famous. And
how did they use that?
Well, you know, for this Spanish Civil War, for the, you know, the heroic
propaganda purposes.
Yeah, propaganda and how heroic these fighters were. And you know, for the communists, really. I did a Guernica situation at Guernica.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
it's also been pushed as a big lie, and they did that to create propaganda for themselves the communists, you know, that the National Socialists flew mm-hmm. these planes and bombed, did all that bombing at Guernica. It was the Germans in their planes.
Yeah, Picasso did that painting.
Yeah, and it wasn't that way at all. These people were these anarchists were burning down the town because the Franco forces were coming in and they were trying to destroy everything. And mm-hmm. all that the Germans bombed was a bridge and a road over on the outside of town. And they had a rule not to ever bomb any Christian churches. Well, they were all Catholic churches there, any churches. And some of the churches were destroyed by they were called the Republicans. And
they were communists?
Yeah, the communists were Republicans. And confuses people. And the others were, I don't know what they called. What were the Franco people called? They were the fascists or something, I guess.
Yeah, and then the nationalists. I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah. And the Republicans, they stored their ammunition and so on in the churches. You know, that's how these communists do. You know, they they did that all over France too. When these churches, when these people were in churches, and then they were killed in these churches.
More churches didn't blow up.
And it wasn't the Germans who blew them up. It was the ammunition that was in there that caught, mm-hmm. got hit. Something and blew them all up. So that's this interesting story about this photograph, which is out there, but probably there's still an awful lot of times when you'd see it, people would see it, all that story would not be told. Mm-hmm. And while I was, you know, I was looking at some people might want to see where is it? New York Times Week in Review. Let me go there. That's where that Ulysses Grant picture came from. But it's got,
they put his head on, right?
Go to the slideshow. And there's just a couple here that are really interesting. One is, it's taken a while to get there.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't include the Lee Harvey Oswald picture.
My clicker's not working very well. Sometimes I think I need to get a new one. Here we go. All right, and there's a lot that wasn't fake, was it? The Lee Harvey Oswald picture?
The one where it looks like his head stuck on, where he's standing there with the rifle. Well, I don't know.
Oh, that's Ulysses Grant, yeah. Well, then they have one here, Abraham Lincoln, and I don't know if this is it looks like a painting, but it's supposed to be a photograph. And I don't know if it was on a magazine cover, but I don't know if it's just, if they actually used it. I guess they did. It's actually the body of John Calhoun, and the whole thing is a portrait of John Calhoun, and then somebody stuck Abraham Lincoln's head.
Right.
And you wouldn't know that it wasn't him, although there's a lot
of black. Yeah, I'm sure I've seen that picture and never suspected.
Black under his neck, yeah. So this is what they could do even a long time ago. And this thing with Grant, Ulysses S. Grant, which it doesn't look very real. I'll give you that. It's not a good job. But it was in 1902.
In
1902, people are saying that during World War II, when you talk about these concentration camp photographs that are supposed to prove different things, you know, in the camps, mm-hmm. About how bad it was. They say, well, they didn't have the technology to do all this photoshopping stuff. Well, they did. And look what they did in 1902. It's not a very good job, but they've got this horse and rider. It shows in the next slide where it came from that there was they have a photograph of Grant just standing by a post or a tree looking mm-hmm. straight at the camera with his hat on. And then they've got this man on horseback looking very, you know, good, mm-hmm. seated very well. And his name is Major General Alexander McDowell McCook. And then they have this background of mm-hmm. the Indians and the people sitting there, Fisher Hill Virginia, an encampment. And so they didn't even use, they didn't even bother to find Grant on a horseback. Just took this guy and put his head on it, and he's staring.
Well, all it takes is just careful work with a knife. You know, you just need a really precise, sharp knife.
Well, they said that some of this was splicing, but now they can do it digitally. They don't have to
Well, of course, now it's digital, but, right. I mean, if you're skilled at it, you could do pretty convincing.
Yeah, and then, of course, there's Stalin, we already see it. But here, the next one after Stalin is an interesting one, Benito Mussolini. I know people probably can't see this. This is the NewYorkTimes.com, 2009, Week in Review. Oh, I don't know. We're talking about things they can't even see. But there's a picture of Mussolini. He's mounted on a horse, too, and he's got a sword in his hand, his arm raised, you know, and, mm-hmm. the horse is absolutely standing still, kind of awfully too still. But then they show the original photograph, and there's a horse handler standing there holding the reins and the muzzle of the horse while to keep him still while what's his name? Mussolini is doing his heroic. You know, it's just that a lot of this isn't so serious, and they have people removed, you know, that they disapprove of, and that's very Orwellian. But then where is this thing? Okay, the next. But it just shows that we see, and there's another one with the Chinese, and they remove the guy because they don't like him anymore, and he's no longer ever mentioned. Then Iwo Jima, a raising of the flag at Iwo Jima. They say that that's not a fake, but people have thought it was, but it's not. How can you tell? How do you know?
Yeah.
But the thing is that we see so much, and we can't say that what we're looking at is, and why this is important is that with all those Holocaust pictures. And you know, you have to really spend some time looking at it and studying it, and you know, not too many people have the time to do that.
Well, if you go to the Wikipedia Holocaust page, right at the top, there's this photograph where they say, and this isn't even faked or anything, it's just the caption that's fake.
Yeah.
And that's a very common thing with Holocaust pictures. You know, they also do the thing of showing victims of Allied bombing and then saying that they were victims of the Germans. You know, that's a really common trick.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is, people who care learn about that and know about it. But the rest of the people,
the other people, they
don't want to know about that. And they just want to believe what they see. And
so picture.
But, you know, on that Wikipedia Holocaust page, I use that very page for a whole program with Christine Miller about these faked photographs, either faked captions or photoshopping or, you know, photo composites and stuff. And at least more than half of the photographs on that page, and there's quite a few of them, are fake photos. And they're on Wikipedia as real as the real thing on Wikipedia.
Right. Yeah. It's just
It's just amazing.
Yeah. People to the left are going to the gas chambers and
Well, they're worse than that. There's ones that are just really, composites in kind of crude ways. Uh-huh. And they've got them on there as though they're the real thing. I think they even have that burning bodies one.
Where they fake in the smoke on the chimneys and smokestacks and stuff.
Yeah. Well, anyway, from here, I don't know what was on this page. No, because I'm done with this one. I also was seeing something about Rosa Parks. So I thought I would bring that up. Okay, get rid of some of this stuff. I've got too much stuff up here. Rosa Parks. You know, this is not a photograph, but who was Rosa Parks? You know, we should be reminded of this. This is another way in which they create these deceptions. Now, most people know that she was a fake. She was a secretary at the NAACP office in Montgomery, Alabama. And she was a political activist with the left wing there, and her sit-in was totally prepared and staged by the communist Jewish-run NAACP, and she attended this Jewish... Did you know all this about her?
No, I didn't.
Oh, well, see, that's amazing you didn't know this. Okay,
well,
I'm glad I'm talking about it.
Yeah.
Because there's got to be other people, too. She had attended the Jewish Highlander School in Tennessee. Yeah, well, I said Jewish because it was a communist-run school, but probably...
I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for Rosa Parks.
Yeah, well, they tell all these lies there, but they do tell.
Yeah, right. No,
they
I'm just trying to get
what happened here. They do give you a lot of this, but they make it sound like it's perfectly normal because the blacks were oppressed, and so they had and these like this Highlander school was something to help I don't know, people develop their protest skills and so on. It was about labor unions a lot, labor organizers and black rabble rousers, but. It was founded in 1932 by members of the Communist Party, and all these blacks and other people went there to, you know, learn tactics and so on and how to be better, you know, protesters. And
the
communists
Museum.
Wanted to promote their workers of the world philosophy, but the Jews wanted to create racial strife in America in order to pave the way for the Jewish Cultural Revolution of the 1960s. So this was in 1955, in December 1st, 1955, that she got on that bus to do what she, intending to do what she was able to do, or maybe hoping she could start something, because others had done this before. They were using this tactic down there, and I think it was all in Montgomery, Alabama. Because in 1946, Irene Morgan did it, and these people were all arrested and charged with, you know, trespassing or breaching the public peace or something. And after that, Sarah Louise Keyes did it earlier in 1955, and she was arrested. And then Claudette Colvin and Aurelia, and four women were arrested some months before Parks doing the same thing. And then... The NAACP organizers thought that Parks was a good candidate. She was the best one for seeing through a court challenge. And so they had her go there, and she, when she was asked to get up and move further back, make room for some more white... I mean, it does sound terrible to us now, but that's the way it was. And I don't like the way it is now, so I don't apologize for any of this. Some more white people had gotten on the bus, and it wasn't okay for white people to stand while colored people sat. So the bus driver, I guess he stops the bus, and he goes back there, and he changes the line for the, you know, where the black people have to remain. And four colored people were supposed to get up and move back further so that these white people could sit in the front part. And three of them got up and did it, because they all did, you know, they all mostly did it, except these protesters. So she moved over to the window and said she wasn't going to move, and so they had to call the police. And that turned out to be the case that, you know, got enough public attention and worked for them, and she became a hero. But she wasn't a tired old woman. She was a secretary in their office, and she had been trained for this kind of thing. So
just waiting for the opportunity, I guess.
Yeah. Well, this brings me to I don't have too much more, so we could go back to your page after, but I've got this little thing about Sandy Hook. Remember I said on Saturday that a woman had gone up to the school right after it happened or something, and said that I thought it was her daughter that pointed out the broken glass at the school entry. Well, I found that today. I was just happened to find it. There was an interview with Katie Couric on the 17th with this with a mother, Barbara Silby, and her husband Phil. They had three kids at the school, and two of them, though, weren't there because they were in kindergarten and they had afternoon kindergarten. But she drove to the school, she said, right at the time school started, with her, because her third grade son had forgotten something. And she said she passed five or six. And this is one of these interviews that looked like fake, you know. And a lot of, everybody was saying afterwards that these people were not real, that this they were not really, you know, who they say they were and so on. But they do live there. And so, you know, they're real. But I don't understand the story they're telling. That she said that she passed, as she was driving up the road, she passed five or six kids running toward the firehouse.
And what time was that supposedly?
Well, it was right around, right at the time that it was happening. It was right at the time that it was happening because of what she says later. She even heard gunfire. So she parked in the parking lot and she noticed she thought that was kind of strange. These kids were running toward the firehouse, but then in the parking lot, she noticed there was a group of men dressed in black and some big van or something. And these men all in black stuff. And she thought, well, gee, that's strange. She thought to herself, this is what she's telling Katie Couric, and her husband's sitting there rubbing her back, you know. And she says, then as she got to the front entrance, another woman also was walking up to the front entrance, and together, then it was this woman who pointed and said, look at that. And she said that the plate glass to the right of the door, wasn't the door that was shattered, but it was the big plate glass to the right of the door, was all shattered and glass everywhere, she said. And she thought, and they were looked at that and they thought, well, that's odd. You know, what does that mean? Then they heard some shots. She said she heard shots and she knew it was gunfire. Then Katie Couric says, well, then you were ushered to the firehouse and blah, blah, and saw the kids coming in lines, you know, being escorted out of the school and coming in. She was waiting for her son to come. And, she finally saw him and she was so relieved. But at the same time, then her husband started talking and he said that maybe she had called him on the way or something. And he said that he arrived and he said he went into the school because she was there and she was there with their son. And there were all these people there protecting them. Who these people were, I don't know, police or something. And, he felt that they were safe or something, and then they all left. Well, this was very unclear while he was talking. It didn't make any sense. And so I say, you know, why aren't there any questions from these people? Why aren't they asking questions about things? And why have we never seen a photograph of that broken glass pane? I really have to conclude this couple is lying. Why they're lying, I don't know. Why they're telling this story. If she walked into the school, but that's what he said, unless he didn't know what he was saying, and he meant to say in the firehouse, that he found her in the firehouse. I don't know, but he said in the school, and he was so happy that she was that they were being protected there. And she said she heard this gunfire, and I have to say, why have we never seen a photograph of that broken pane of glass? I mean,
we haven't seen photographs of anything.
Yeah, but that's the least they could do because they could still be outside and they could show that picture. And they've never shown such a picture.
Well, there could be all kinds of pictures. I mean, if you think about it, everybody's got an iPhone now. Everybody's got, you know, the capacity to take pictures and videos and all kinds of things. So if you imagine 1,000 parents rushing up to the school, and 500 or 600 kids running out of the school, somebody in there is bound to have an iPhone or a camera and take a picture. I mean, wouldn't you think?
Well, even these kids have phones.
Right, even the kids have phones. So we haven't seen any of that. There's none of that. I mean, if you go to Google Images and do Sandy Hook or anything about Sandy Hook, you always see the same 4, 5, or 6 pictures over and over and over again. Those are the only ones you see.
Right. Well, that's just impossible. It's impossible that there's no pictures.
I mean, especially considering the number of people.
So I don't know whether there was any broken glass, you know, that she's saying that. And why is she saying that? Why are these people doing this? Well, there's this story.
Well, supposedly he shot his way into the building, is what they're saying.
Yeah, but I mean, why are these people going along with it?
Right, why are they going along with it? That's the good question. That's the big question.
But now they're talking about, you know, they've talked a lot about these actors. And somebody found that on this, and I looked, it's true, on this Katie Couric interview that I just told you about, people can find it if they Google it, I'm sure, the Katie Couric CBS interview with Barbara Silbey. Barbara Silbey, S-I-L-B-E-Y. And there's all these comments there. And a whole bunch of these comments, not the first ones, but after you get down a ways, all of a sudden all these people are writing in that are putting, they're not signing it, but they're adding a number that they're cast, and then B, like this one is B88 from Krista Stewart, and others are, you know, C, you know, 59, you know, they go A, B, C, and D, and then they have numbers like, I guess, a date, or no, I don't know what the number means, I forgot. Anyway, there's a whole bunch of them, and they're all positive. They're not any of the critical ones. Earlier, there's all these critical ones. People aren't believing this.
Oh, in the comments.
In
the YouTube page with the interview.
It's not on YouTube. It's on a CBS page.
Oh, okay.
It's a CBS page, and they left them all there. They all have these. Some of them have cast, and then their letter and number, and some don't have cast, just the letter and number. But they're also, this person did it on Clues Forum, and then I looked at it all, that there's this organization called Up With People, and a lot of them use those letters, UWP, you know, in their comment. So they're all like, you know, letting the others know that they're these Up With People friends, and this is an organization that was founded by somebody named Jay Blanton Belt. This, you know, when I tried to move, I got to Up With People, and I looked at one page, and when I tried to move to other pages, you know, click on things, I started just getting, error and or it would take real long time. And then it would say time's up, or, you know, you're timed out, and so on. I couldn't get anywhere. I finally gave up, and I had gotten some information, though. And then I went to looked it up on Wikipedia, and you can read about it. It's there, too.
So upwithpeople.org. I'm trying to get on there.
Yeah. Site. Oh, yeah. Try and see how much success you have. I got on it finally, but I couldn't move around on it without having a lot of trouble. I think they might know, they might have some idea who's trying to access that, and when they don't like you, you're not on the right amongst the right people, they don't let you do it. But Jay Blanton Belk started this in 1965. Just think, 1965, during saying it was something to be a positive voice for young people. It's headquartered in Denver, Colorado, has satellites in Belgium and Mexico, and it's a they call themselves a global, everything about it is global. Global education and arts organization whose goal is to bridge cultural barriers and create global understanding through service and music. And they divide their year into semesters. So that would be the four, you know, A, B, C, and D, I guess. And and they have classes, they call them CAS. And they say a UWP semester, each group called a CAS, after training in Denver, travels to nearly 20 communities across two or three continents per semester, spending about 1 week in each community. You know, they live with the people.
Perform with Bob Hope for President Nixon. Perform at the Super Bowl.
Well, they do musicals and stuff. But I think it's possible that all these alumni from this are very globalized citizens, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's certain of them who seem to be stick together, and they have acting ability, and they might be the people that they draw on for performing in these crises. Yeah, they're crisis actors, and they're not very good, but you know, They do it. I mean, you try to understand.
So they're in Denver. That's interesting because a lot of the early posts on Sandy Hook were saying that there's actually a company in Denver that specializes in providing crisis actors.
Yeah, there is a crisis actors organization
in Denver.
Up with people is not that, I don't think.
I'm not saying the same thing, but it's interesting they're in the same place.
Yeah, it is. So what's
and
going on in Denver?
They also provide actors for drills, of course.
That's right. They come right out and say so. Now, this has been kind of something, supposed to be something else. But it may be that it started this way, and then it sort of had a heyday, and then it kind of had a downturn and wasn't much happening there. But they may make use of the people that have been through there to do some of these things. I don't know, but I find it a very unusual organization. What I find unusual is that all these people on that CBS page wrote a comment and put their up with people number.
That's very odd. So they're like
they identify themselves that way, and they're all writing.
Maybe they're all friends with the person and people in the interview.
Well, yeah. So they were writing to be supportive, and you know, say, oh, we love you, and we're praying for you, and good. You know, and all this stuff. I mean, a bunch of them.
Oh, my God.
A bunch of them. And they all had this number. I never saw anything like it.
Huh.
Very strange. And you'd think that they would have removed all those, but they didn't. They're still there if anybody wants to go look.
So is this the interview with Daniel Barden's brother and sister? Is that the one?
This is the interview, as I said, with...
Katie Couric conducting the interview.
Katie Couric and... let me keep losing it. Way up here. I'm moving things around. Barbara Silby and husband Phil.
Oh, okay.
Her son was named Daniel. Hmm. And some of these people, their kids don't have their name, you know? I don't know. You know, a lot of these people, they give the kid's name and it's different from the parent's name. So, like, the parent remarried or something and got a different name. But anyway, her son, I think he was Daniel, because she was talking about what she said to him and everything. And the father was so weird. The father said, oh, I don't know the things these people say.
The YouTube video has got all kinds of negative, rude comments.
Well, they're like that on YouTube.
Yeah. I guess CBS monitors their comments.
Well, okay, we've got a few minutes left, that's all. Did you want to go back to... we've got 5 minutes or so. Would you like to go back and talk about anything that you got?
I mean, I can't help but see the contrast between what we're talking about, like with Sandy Hook, you know, where there's this deception going on and everybody's confused and nobody knows what the heck's going on. And it's, you know, what is our... So what is the social agenda of America? What is the social agenda of the people who are pulling off these stunts? You know, we're all just kind of lost. You know, we can see that there's deceptions going on, but we don't have anything to latch on to go forward, you know, except our associations with each other and the things we talk about and the things we're trying to create. But it's such a contrast to what, you know, I'm reading about Germany under National Socialism, where there was this real unity going on, where there was no deception. You know, Hitler was not a deceiver. He was doing exactly what he said he was doing. And the same was true with the government and the party. You know, the party was there to provide unity for the people. And again, they were doing exactly what they said they were doing. And it just kind of shows the potential power and force that can be achieved when you have a population of people that are all on the same page doing the same thing.
Well, they use deception to turn everybody against... against National Socialism and boy, how successful they were. So this is, I think, what we have to work at exposing these things and getting more and more people to see how much of this has been going on and is still going on, and that they don't have a clue. You know, I don't know how, but I think it's very important. I keep doing these shows, but I think it's very important to expose people to these deceptions.
That's kind of the first step.
Yeah, if we go directly to Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, well, nobody's going to be too responsive, although it has made a lot of progress. A lot of people have changed their mind about it, in probably
the thing that's important to me
years.
About National Socialism, it's a model. It's a model of some. It's an approach that actually worked until it was destroyed. It worked very well.
Yeah, but only people who get out of that mindset that there's, you know, that they were bad are open to seeing that. So you have to show people how they mm-hmm. how they do these deceptions.
Oh yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. That's the first step.
Yeah,
but I think it's also important to provide some hope to provide to say, you know, it's one thing. You know, we have to see the deceptions. There's no question about that, and that's a struggle all on its own because people don't want to look. You know, they just don't want to know. There's so many.
Well, the media, I think too. You know. Haddon Scott has said that he thinks it's the media that is the main culprit in perpetrating all this stuff, and I have now decided I think that's true.
But they're a tool of a bigger purpose. They're not doing it on their own.
Yeah, but they are a tool of a bigger purpose. But they are Jewish. I mean, it's all.
Oh yeah,
No question. It's all the same. There doesn't seem to be any distance at all between who runs the media and who runs everything else.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, they saw to that long ago. I mean, whatever the form of media that's current, whether it's books or magazines.
What would you say would be the first step in your mind? I'm piping in too much here. What would be the first thing, the most important thing in your mind, to make a difference?
Well, we have to. I mean, exposing the deceptions is critical. I mean, there's no question that that's got to be right there among the first steps. But then there also has to be solutions. We also have to think of some solutions. What do we do? I mean, how do we deal with this? How do we go forward?
Yeah, but what?
What would be
the most important thing to change?
Yeah, well, I mean, I see it as a spiritual crisis.
So you think we need to get back to our spiritual basis, and starting with Jesus would be a good place. I mean, starting with defending the reality.
Yeah, I mean, recent polls are showing that more and more people are describing themselves as spiritual but not religious. So there's a turning away from organized religion, from institutional religion, which I can totally understand. I mean, I'm saying.
Okay, we're gonna have to say goodnight, Harlan.
Okay.
Harlan Schulke has been my guest. This is the Heretics Hour. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and we have just run out of time. I will put all these links, though, ladies and gentlemen, on the post page. So go there and look so you can take a look at all the things we talked about.
Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.